brightness around first thing, but the rain arrives later, and then it turns very windy through the course of the night. Parts of northwest Scotland could see gusts of wind up to 80 miles per hour, 60 mile per hour gusts through the central belt. Temperatures of 7 degrees in Aberdeen, 10 in Glasgow. Wednesday is another windy day with further heavy showers and the risk of flooding. That's all for now. It's back to you, Luke.
Ben, thank you. Now on radio for our Book of the Week, William Dalrymple introduces his new account of the first British invasion of Afghanistan, Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan. The reader is Tim Pigott-Smith.
In the dog days of October 1837, a young British officer, Henry Rawlinson, found himself stranded at night in the disputed borderlands between Persia and Afghanistan. As dawn was breaking over the jagged rim of the mountains, Rawlinson saw another party of horsemen riding down on them. On cantering past, he wrote, I saw to my astonishment men in Cossack dresses. Rawlinson's chance sighting of a large Russian party heading into Afghanistan was to the first Afghan war what the weapons of mass destruction was to the invasion of Iraq in our own day. A single piece of ambiguous intelligence was manipulated by a group of ideologically driven hawks into a reason to invade an independent country. For 150 years, the British East India Company had been gobbling up the rich lands of India. As fast as Britain was advancing northwest, so the Russian Empire had been heading southwards and annexing huge chunks of Central Asia. Anyone looking on a map could see that Russia and Britain would soon come to blows somewhere in the Hindu Kush. The British hawks were determined to beat their Russian rivals and seize the crossroads of Central Asia. Using Rawlinson's sighting of the Cossacks as an excuse, a plan was formed to depose the Afghan Emir Dost Muhammad and replace him with a puppet ruler who had long been exiled in British India, Shah Shuja ul-Mulk. It took only 18 months from that first sighting to an entire British army being mobilised to invade the then almost unknown country of Afghanistan.
The Simla season, thought Emily Eden, had got off to a most satisfactory start. We give sundry dinners and occasional balls, she wrote happily to her sister in England. Meanwhile, high on his Himalayan ledge, her brother, George Auckland, Governor-General of India, was finalising his plans for the full-scale British invasion of Afghanistan and the return of a king. The plan was, in principle, a good one. First, there would be a ceremonial send-off at Ferozepur in the Punjab. Then, Afghanistan would be invaded by two routes. One army would move north up the Khyber Pass towards Jalalabad. The other would then head through the Balan Pass to attack southern Afghanistan. Both forces would converge on Kabul to restore Shuja to his throne in the Bala Hisar fort. The problem was that Shuja at this point had no troops, so the first thing was to create a new army. The recruits were so wild and raw, however, and so undisciplined, that this rabble of ragamuffins were quietly marched off out of sight to begin intensive drilling. Before long, the contingent had deviated from its intended route and run amok. Ominously, the revival of Shuja's fortunes seemed already to have gone to his head. Before long, the Shah had fallen out with all his British officers, alienating them with his haughtiness. He also alarmed his British minders by referring to the Afghans, his future subjects, as a pack of dogs, one and all. George Auckland and his sister Emily set off from Simla in the middle of a monsoon downpour, and in the Bombay rain, regiments began streaming from their barracks down to the beaches to be loaded on board troop transports and ferried across the stormy sea to Karachi. To everyone's relief, the rains had stopped by the time the now grandly named Army of the Indus began to assemble on the plains of Ferozepur in early November. To try and cheer up the camp, Maharaja Ranjit Singh, ruler of the Punjab, sent 600 of his gardeners to arrange impromptu gardens of potted roses around the officers' tents. News now came that Russia and Persia were publicly backing down, so any threat to British India was over. This would have been an ideal moment to reopen negotiations with the current ruler, Amir Dost Muhammad, Instead, Auckland made a strong public declaration that he intended to prosecute with vigour the existing plan to invade Afghanistan. On the 27th of November, the Sikh and East India Company armies finally converged on the plains of Ferozpur. 2 days later, led forward by lancers with scarlet cloaks and plumed shakos, the columns of cavalry and infantry regiments headed downstream. The Army of the Indus now consisted of around 1,000 Europeans and 14,000 East India Company sepoys, accompanied by no fewer than 38,000 Indian camp followers. The baggage for these men was to be carried to war on over 30,000 camels. No one was planning to travel light. Many young officers would as soon have thought of leaving behind their swords and double-barreled pistols as march without their dressing cases, their perfumes, Windsor soap and eau de cologne, wrote Major General William Knott. The only people impressed by the Army of the Indus were the Afghans, who, unaware of the lack of coordination, discipline and foreplanning, heard nothing but exaggerated stories about the size of the enormous force heading towards them. On the very last day of February, the invasion force finally crossed the Indus. It was only at this point, entering the 150 miles of sterile salt marshes separating Shikarpur from the Balan Pass, that it seemed to have dawned on William McNaughton, the envoy, and his generals, exactly what they had taken on. A campaign far from their own territory, through a hostile, parched, and largely unmapped landscape, guarded on all sides by unwilling and unreliable allies. Summer was now approaching, and the desert was rapidly beginning to warm up, so the marches through the empty wilderness had to be conducted at night. A young infantryman, Thomas Seaton, found it almost unbearable from the very beginning. "As soon as we entered into the desert," he wrote, "a wind sprang up, hot and fierce, bringing with it particles of dust which penetrated everything, and with the heat still radiating from the soil, created an intolerable thirst. The sepoys, each with his heavy musket, 60 rounds of ammunition, haversack with necessaries, and his brass pot filled with water, were heavily laden for such a march, the burden doubling the already unbearable oppression of their tight-fitting woollen uniforms." Shuja put a good face on the privations of the march, but was as anxious as everyone else about the lack of planning and the growing problems with Baluchi marauders. He was also worried by the slow response from his future subjects to his letters, entreating them to rally to his standard. Mihrab Khan, the leader of the territory the army was heading into, now made clear his strong disapproval of Shuja returning to power as the puppet of the British. On a hot, moonlit night march, the troops caught their first glimpse of the man for whom they were risking their lives. "Shah Shuja is an old man, about 60 years of age," wrote Neville Chamberlain, a young cavalry officer. "His beard reaches down to his waist and is naturally white, but to make himself look younger, he dyes it black." From the blinding white salt marshes of Dadur, the shimmering heat haze of the desert flatlands slowly gave way to rolling foothills. These, in turn, scrolled up to the silvery outlines of dragons' backs rising in the distance from a summer dust storm, the great mountains of southern Afghanistan. If the vertical cliff walls initially shielded the sepoys from the direct rays of the sun, the rocks reflected the heat into their faces like an open tandoor. By day, the thermometers in the airless tents registered 119 degrees. At night, the air was filled with the moans of dying camels and camp followers. "It was the mouth of hell," remembered the sepoy Sita Ram. There was now a gathering crescendo of attacks by Baluchi brigands. A lack of coordination with local chieftains meant that the tribes of the area looked on the vulnerable British columns as fair game. The troops were generally left well alone, but the unprotected camp followers began to be robbed and murdered on a daily basis. The Afghan writer, Mirza Attar, noted, "Thousands of pack animals, camels, horses, elephants, and their loads were lost." The entourage of Shah Shuja felt lucky to make it through alive as they dodged the bullets raining down on the column from Baluch snipers, sheltering in the faults and crevices of the rocks above. Food had by this stage almost completely run out among the camp followers. I saw one day the body of a man who had died by the wayside in the act of gnawing gristle from the carcass of a dead bullock, reported one officer. But there was relief ahead. On the far side of the Kozhak, the invading army found itself in rolling pasture land. Occasional herds of fat-tailed sheep and shaggy brown goats belonging to Kuchi nomads were watched over by tall men in white turbans and purple robes. Wherever there was water, a cool shade could be found behind the screens of poplar. The army of the Indus was now closing in on its first serious challenge, Kandahar. There were rumours that Barakzai cavalry units were in the vicinity, circling the army, ready to strike. "We were, at this time, utterly unfit for active warfare," noted Thomas Gaisford in his journal. Then, on the 20th of April, the army of the Indus had its first real break. A messenger arrived announcing that one of Dost Muhammad's most prominent nobles was waiting beyond the camp with 200 followers, ready to offer his allegiance to Shah Shuja. At last, one of the letters sent by the Shah had borne fruit. 5 days later, on the 25th of April, 1839, Shah Shuja rode in triumph through fields of ripe wheat and barley, and the rich belt of walled gardens and orchards that still surround the outskirts of Kandahar. On the way, he received delegation after delegation of townspeople coming out to welcome him. Shuja's first action was to make his way to the tomb of his grandfather. Having prayed at the grave, he then went next door to the shrine built for Afghanistan's most sacred relic, the woolen kirka, or mantle said to have belonged to the Prophet Muhammad. This Shuja took in his hands and hugged to his chest, tears streaming down his face. In 1996, Mullah Omar would come here when he was awarded the same title by the Pashtun Ulema, and he too would swathe himself in the Prophet's cloak, to give him the religious authority to bring all the people of Afghanistan under Taliban control. "This is a very delightful place," wrote Thomas Gaisford in a letter the following week. "The scenery is most romantic, the climate fine, and the fruit such as you cannot conceive in abundance. The dried peaches, apricots, raisins, plums, and mulberries are in profusion." From the palace of Kandahar, McNaughton wrote to Auckland in triumph, "I am happy to be able to report that the town and territory of Kandahar are in a state of profound tranquility." 10 days later, on the 8th of May, just after the last troops of the rearguard of the Bombay column had finally limped into the camp outside the city, McNaughton organized a grand durbar for Shuja. A magnificently canopied throne was raised on a small platform of mud at the Eidgah outside the city walls. "Nothing could exceed the splendor of the costumes in which the chiefs were clad," noted one officer, "their turbans and weapons being studded with diamonds and other precious stones." To the sound of an Indian regimental brass band playing "God Save the King," Shuja was ceremonially enthroned as King of Afghanistan.
Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan by William Dalrymple was read by Tim Pigott-Smith, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. sailing by. Now, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Tuesday, the 29th of January. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Bailey 963, losing its identity by 1800 on Tuesday. New low moving rapidly northeast, expected Bailey 953 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Zira, south at Zira. Southeasterly 6 to gale 8, veering southwesterly 4 or 5 for a time, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Occasional rain, moderate, occasionally poor. Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber. South or southwest, 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later in Forties, Cromarty and Forth. Rain or showers.